You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. Long time no speak. Been a few years, but it's always a pleasure speaking with you, Congresswoman. I did a search, of course, as anyone can do on the internet, and found just one recent article, a relatively recent article with you in it about teaming up with, I guess, this fella Steele. To fight the deep state, which was a good article. It was a fine article. I see they tried to pin you down about who you voted for. And they couldn't. not that it matters, you know, who cares, right?
But, well, I didn't vote for Hillary. Actually, it was Robert David Steele who reached out to me. And that kind of a coming together, at least symbolically, well, it proved to be very financially viable because he raised about $250,000 off of us just coming together. When you're going out there, you really have to have so much discipline. And it's not something that you learn except other than by sort of tough experience. But I ended up just kind of dissociating because he just didn't have any discipline. And the people that contacted us and wanted to help us, he would end up offending them. While he's wonderful at research, but not so much a people person, and it just kind of deteriorated. And so anyways, adhering to certain sort of public standards of if you say something, then you need to be able to justify it. And you got to be able to defend it, at least provide evidence for it. You know, don't just throw things out. But it was a wonderful, I think, template for how we really do need to go about taking our country back. So I've got this idea of power cells, and it would sort of replicate the hashtag Unrig project on a state-by-state basis, because it's going to really take, how can I say, us unrigging our minds, because we have been rigged just as the system was rigged. Well, we couldn't operate in the system unless we also got some rigging. And that's the purpose of the Hollywood and the fake news and all of the things that now we take for granted that we know about, because Trump has crystallized these concepts so effectively with his small talk, they say. But he said in two words, fake news, what I've been trying to say for 20 years, you know?
Yes, no, you're 100% right. And no matter what anyone wants to say about the guy, what he did was he made it fashionable to mock out the news, which prior to that pretty much maintained a vaunted position within the eyes of the public. Yes. So, no, I agree with you 100%. And that's right. And so here, Trump, being a part of the arts, being on television, and yes, I guess a show or two, I don't know, I don't watch TV, but being on television, being a celebrity, being a public figure, it was easy for him to transition from that and then take down probably single-handedly the entire fake news media structure.
Well, now, here's where I would say not exactly single-handedly, because he has a faction of the deep state behind him. And, of course, he also had what most of us don't have, and I absolutely didn't have, as I was trying to garner support and tell my story, was I didn't have $1 billion backing me. I didn't have an uncle who was an MIT professor who was the last person who was in Nikola Tesla's apartment or hotel room where he stayed after he died and collecting his papers. Trump also had some tentacles into the deep state. And so then they were able to reach out to him and pull him in and prop him up so that he could become what he is today. And quite frankly, I'm glad he's there. And I'm also quite pleased with the disruptive role that he's playing, although I wish there were a little bit more disruption.
No, I know what you're saying, and I'm not, we're on the same page with that. I personally get a lot of great enjoyment in seeing him shake up this establishment. You were in the House for, what was it, 6 terms?
Yes.
Wow. And you know this Congressman Buck out of Colorado? Well, he wrote a book recently. I think it was called Drain the Swamp. And yes, and what he says is that Congress people actually have to pay for their committee assignments. So he actually revealed that in there.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yes. So
that's true.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I actually work in Asia, and that's not because I love an exotic life. It's because I've been so blackballed, and I'm on every list that it's possible to be on that no one would ever in their wildest dreams even think about hiring me for a position in the U.S.
Yes, you are blackballed, and that's the way it should be. If you're telling the truth, then of course. So I wouldn't expect anything else, especially from you. from that. No, really, because obviously you're not a phony and you're telling the truth, and that's the most important thing to you. So they're going to blackball you.
Yeah, that's right. This is an extremely important moment in the history of our country. It's also not just for the United States, but for the globe because of the tentacles that the U.S. has. And it's extremely important for me personally to be involved in that movement of quote unquote, take our country back, because I do not believe that those who lost the country can do it alone.
You're 100% right. They can't.
But I think they think they can.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's a big disconnect. I think you're right. And it has to be a grassroots effort.
Yes. That's right. That's right. And we're going to have to involve all aspects of the U.S. community.
Yes. What about this cell program that you're working on? Can you elaborate on that?
Well, the power cells is just an idea rolling around in my head. But I got my PhD in leadership and change. And a lot of, well, half of it is leadership and half of it is change. So we do leadership that we did. Leadership theory, and we did change theory. And change theory is particularly important in, I believe, moving U.S. corporations from where they used to be into sort of leadership position of being able to contend with whatever the global weather was in terms of business developments. Because quite frankly, the U.S. was, through its research and development, it was creating a lot of that weather. Okay. So we have the behavioral sciences that focus on how you lead individual change, how you lead group change, and how you lead systemic whole system change. So I'm looking at the change on all three levels through the tools of the behavioral sciences. The power cells is kind of like a total quality management project for the political system of the United States. It's like that. So that's why the engagement in all 50 states. So anyway, I'm going to sit down. Actually, August 1 is the day that I set August aside for sort of putting a proposal together to see if I could get somebody, part of these blockchain cryptocurrency folks, to get them interested in funding the idea. Sort of the tagline is changing our country by changing ourselves. And the mission is something like, I've done mission vision, and I can send all of this to you so that it doesn't take so much time. But the mission would be to defeat the deep state by defeating their tactic of divide and rule.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the way that you're approaching it is probably going to work out. Aligning with these, you know, nowadays things move so fast and the youth have this whole new way of doing things. But
yes, that's right.
And we have to keep up or we're dead meat, as they say. But
if you can think of a way to get this message across in a way, like you say, that is informative, educational, and entertaining, it can't be boring. It would be fabulous. It would be fabulous because I think then it can become a tool that all of us can use in order to illuminate the swamp. Because according to my analysis, which you've probably maybe listened to since I've been doing too many interviews, is that there's three factions of the deep state. And Trump represents what I call the pilgrims. But then you've got the Ziocons, who are now fighting among themselves. So they've split into two different factions. But in these wars, the interminable wars, are where there is mutual agreement between the Ziocon faction and the Pilgrim faction. It was only when Obama decided that he was going to do to Syria what he had just completed doing in Libya, but the international context had changed, because when Libya was done, it was Medvedev. When Syria was done, it's Putin and Xi. It's a whole different ball game. And so then, with the U.S. military recognizing that it was a whole different ball game, General Dempsey marches to the White House at 2 o'clock in the morning and says, hey, 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 almost like over my dead body, you're going to start the bombing campaign against Syria. And then we get to this point. Had Hillary been elected, it wouldn't have mattered, because she's a complete tool, pawn, vessel for the Ziocons, and we would be engaged in World War III, as Trump has even himself said. At least he's sort of trying, at least it appears, to disengage somewhat. I support the engagement with the North Koreans and the drawdown in Syria, the engagement with the Russians. It's a different kind of engagement. They can call it isolationism if they want to. But the bottom line is that the United States needs to protect its own national interests, and the U.S. national interest is not equivalent to the Israeli national interest.
Right. And of course, the recent reaching out to Iran that has been publicized.
Yes, that's right.
Let me ask you about this pledge, because not very many people know about it. And that's understandable, because people really have to want to understand the issue here, and many don't. But it was on a program on, I think it was Al Jazeera, or...
No, it was Press TV.
Press TV, right, right. Thank
yeah.
you.
Press and it TV. Was a girlfriend of mine, Marzieh Hashemi, who is a U.S. citizen who lives in Iran. It was in her interview that I first disclosed it. And it really, really hit them hard. Because it was sort of like the secret about the former member of Congress saying, I don't know if he's former or if he's current, who said they buy their committee assignments kind of thing. So it was like accepted. And the reason I believe it was accepted is basically all of political money in the U.S. Well, now you've got more people involved, but the Zionist Israel First money is what underpins the Democratic Party, and it used to be, to a lesser extent, the Republican Party, but now the Republican Party and the Democratic parties, both. And then if you look at political action committees, who finances them, because it doesn't matter. So like in the PAC book, you'll have a little divider. It says ideological PACs. And under ideological PACs, that's where they put the pro-Israel PACs. But no, that's not how it works. The way it works is that the pro-Israel money is in your environmental PAC. It's in your labor union PACs. It's in your corporate PACs. It's across the board. And the person who really identified this and put it on the congressional record is Gus Savage. That's why if you go to my website, you'll see Gus Savage on the front page, because he tells the whole story about how he was targeted by the Israel First contingent and the tactic that they used against him. They didn't get him the first time, but they got him the second time.
Yes. Another great American.
And I'll tell you something else, Rod Blagojevich. Blagojevich is in prison today. These people play for keeps. He's in prison not because he had a conversation. It's because of his appointment to the Senate. The Israel First people, they had their candidate that he was supposed to appoint to the U.S. Senate, and he didn't do that. And if you'll recall, what he appointed was a black man. And that was not a part of the script, and they sought their revenge. Now, who's going to say that in public? But that is the underlying reason for his prosecution. You can go to Jim Trafficant. I mean, they've got a whole trail of people who have been in prison. You can go to Bob Ney from Ohio. You can go to Kurt Weldon. He didn't go to prison, but he got kicked out with an FBI raid just because he talked about 911. So you've got a trail of detritus, the carcasses of politically dead politicians. which my carcass is there as well for the vultures to feed on. And that's why when the signing of the pledge, nobody said anything about it, but I was offended by it. And my entire 12 years in Congress was bumping up against these people who controlled everything. They literally controlled the budget. They controlled, well, the budget process, what got in the budget, what got a line item. And it was just a horrible experience for me. It was like, what do you call that? Trench warfare. Every day fighting just for a position that should have come naturally as a part of trying to take our country back and do the right thing for our country.
Many people have heard the term ZOG, Z-O-G, Zionist Occupied Government. Is it ZOG?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I'm sure that folks who aren't up to speed on these matters, when they hear a term like that, they would look at the person who would say it and think that they're off their rocker and they're a conspiracy theorist. But yeah, you were there for 12 years, so
yeah.
If anyone would know it, you would know it.
Which, of course, is what makes me dangerous, because absolutely. I can run around these folk. I can sniff them out. If there's a smell test, I can pass it, right? And therein lies the problem.
Exactly. This particular show with your friend on Press TV, you said, well, every candidate for Congress at that time had a pledge, given a pledge to sign. And I was new on the scene. And so the pledge had Jerusalem as a capital city, the military supreme, and she cut you off and she said, American Congress people have to sign this pledge. My first question is, did the pledge take the form of physical paper?
Yes, the pledge was a piece of paper that was faxed to my home, which is where I was receiving all of the faxes in the early days of my candidacy back in 1992. And now, of course, with me having been strewn everywhere in my possessions as well, I don't really have a single place. So I don't have that physical sheet of paper. But what I do have is the, I think it's CUFI, C-U-F-I, which is a UK organization that, guess what? Requires MPs to sign a pledge. So I can't show the U.S. one, but there's a U.K. one.
Wow. So the pledge was an actual physical piece of paper. Do you know who actually sent it over to you?
Yes, it was from AIPAC.
That's called chutzpah.
Yes.
Then you said if you don't sign the pledge, you don't get money. So, for example, it was almost like water torture for me. I love that. My parents observed this. I would get a call, and the person on the other end of the phone would say, I want to do a fundraiser for you. How many times did this happen separately where you would get a call from an individual wanting to do a fundraiser?
Many times. Two or three, four times. No more than that, though. But, you know, this is a huge campaign, and this is a huge thing. If you get someone who wants to do a fundraiser for you. And then the final one, the final time that they reared their ugly head was, I can't remember now if I was already in Congress or if it was still that first campaign. No, it must have been that I was already in. So I was running for re-election. And of course, I had not signed the pledge. I got away with not signing the pledge. Even after I was elected the first time, I was able to get Tea with Tipper event coordinated. And what happened? Okay, the Tea with Tipper, and maybe the day before, I was presented with this demand to say I'm not anti-Semitic. So I was forced to write something on a sheet of paper that I wasn't anti-Semitic. Invitations had gone out. The event was set, but you see, the problem that I had was that the event was set to be at the home of an Israel firster. That was my mistake. I left myself open to the blackmail, and they used it.
Right. Well, you can't know everything, especially in that swamp.
I just didn't know.
You lasted 12 years without ever signing the pledge, right?
Yeah, except that I did have to write that thing under duress in order to get the Tipper Gore thing done like the next day. But other than that, no, I never signed a pledge. I never went to Israel on those trips either.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
For not doing that. The people, the three or four times that they contacted you to do a fundraiser for you. And of course, as you said, 2 or 3 weeks later, they said, oh yeah, hey, did you sign the pledge?
Right.
Do you know who they were? Do you remember who these individuals were, or at least their positions in this Zionist power structure?
One, I kind of remember as being the owner of a club or a nightclub or a restaurant, or, you know, these were people who were of means, who ordinarily would not support a black girl from Georgia. I mean, you know, these are Georgia people with all that that means. They would not be the kind of people who would be supporting me for a congressional seat. But they did, provided that I accepted what was being presented to me without asking any questions. Unfortunately for me, I never did that. I always was asking questions. And so I had one Jewish friend, really. I wouldn't even call it a supporter. I would call him a friend. He gave me my first job. He was friends with my dad, just like family friend. Well, when this thing happened and I'm in Congress and I'm not cooperating, I'm not signing the pledge, then what happened was my friend said, okay, I'm going to try and broker a peace between Cynthia and quote unquote the community. So he arranged a meeting. This was all the highfalutin, the ADL person, the AJC person, all of the highfalutin people in the metro Atlanta area. We had a home and everybody came to the home, and my friend did a valiant job of trying to defend and protect me. He said, he told them, look, you got to respect her intellect. She's a thinker and you need to respect her. That's what his plea was. Just respect her mind, respect her ability to think and her desire to think and not just be a robot. And he ended his plea by saying, you can't treat her like you treat the help. This is what my friend said. And so the meeting ended. There was a little child there. He was about 6 years old. My congressional staff were present at the meeting. They heard this as well. And I thanked the little boy for hosting me in his home. And he said to me, this is 6 years old, anything for Israel. And me and my staffers, we just looked at each other because we weren't meeting about Israel. But the way this was interpreted, this meeting was really about Israel. And so that's what caused my dad to say, what does Stone Mountain, Georgia have to do with Israel? And that was the question that we raised. What does Stone Mountain, which is the place that I represented, have to do with Israel? And clearly, because of the way I was treated and the fact that I lost the election, well, we'll just say it was tampered with, but at the end of the day, the election result was not favorable to me. My conclusion is that, one, Israel has everything to do with the politics of Stone Mountain, because the interests of Israel can override the interests of the people of Stone Mountain and the United States. That's point number one. And then point number two is that the way the system has been manipulated or rigged to work in the U.S. is that I will not be successful as a member of Congress unless I love Israel more than I love my constituency. That's the way it works in the U.S. now.
I just wanted to ask, Congresswoman, you said...
Cynthia.
Cynthia, thank you. When your friend cut you off a couple times, and I don't think she did it on purpose. She was probably just so excited about what you were saying, but you said that the pledge consisted of, first, that Jerusalem is the capital.
Yes.
That military superiority of Israel, economic...
Yes.
Do you remember exactly what the items were on that pledge?
I only remember those first three. There were either 5 or 7. I can't remember, but there were 5 or 7 points, and I remember Jerusalem is the capital city, the military superiority of Israel, and remember at the time, George Herbert Walker Bush, well, his tenure as president had been cut short because he was demanding the end of the settlements. There was this housing money that the Israelis wanted, and he was withholding it, $10 million, or probably could have been more than that. But it was some amount of money for housing, and George Herbert Walker Bush got in trouble
And so as a result of that experience, that's how these items were making it onto the pledge because of previous controversies that had arisen. What happened with Jerusalem, what Trump did, Jerusalem, the Congress passed the Jerusalem as a capital city law a long time ago. So every president would just waive recognition of it. But that was the status all along. All Trump did was to recognize that it was the law of the land. And of course, in so recognizing, raising the contradictions that exist and that were created by this position, by this U.S. position, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah. Thank you for explaining that. I wanted to know how many there were.
There were about seven. There were more than three. The third one that I remember was about keeping the levels of aid consistent with Israel's request so that I would not vote for aid levels to go down.
Wow. In other words, do everything that Israel wants.
Yes. You don't get a vote in Congress that controversial, 400 to one or two or 400, usually it's 400 to nothing. You don't get that by accident. Those are purposeful votes. Say in the Senate, when Ben Cardin has a bill, you know you better vote for that bill. Back in my day, it was Tom Lantos. Tom Lantos, what's the guy's name? Elliot Engel is still there. Jerry Nadler is still there. A lot of them are still there. You knew when there would be certain point people. And when those point people, Jerry Ackerman was one of them back in the day, when they authored legislation, and then this came out later in a real concrete example, you knew that that was AIPAC speaking. And if AIPAC was talking, they were also in the room taking notes on who said what during the deliberations of the bill. And you didn't want to be on that side. AIPAC also was in the room monitoring who was signing the letters, like, you know, you send a letter to the president saying, I urge you to do X and Y. And those letters were generated by AIPAC. The legislation was generated by AIPAC. Then what happened was, I think it was Tom Daschle's office. No. Not Tom Daschle. It was Gephardt, I believe. I believe it was Gephardt. He might have still been there. Maybe it was whoever succeeded him. Maybe, no, it was probably Steny Hoyer. But anyway, what happened during the time I was there, or maybe just after I left, there was a letter or bill or something that AIPAC had sent over to one of the congressional offices, and the congressional office was not savvy enough to erase the original title, which was AIPAC. So that's how then that became like a little mini firestorm. But there is no such thing as a real firestorm with AIPAC because they are able to suppress everything.
Yeah, Cynthia, you were on a ship trying to break the illegal Gaza blockade. It looks like back in 2008 and 2009, and of course, this just happened again, and this particular ship was, as it says in this headline, violently seized by the Israelis. What's your feeling about this, attempting to break the blockade? Is that just a pipe dream?
Well, I think it's useful. It's extremely expensive because basically the boats are destroyed. I think there was really only one ship, quote unquote ship, and that was the ship, the Mavi Marmara, that I was actually supposed to be on. And, you know, here's the thing that's very interesting about this, because Israeli newspapers published on two occasions that I was going to be on that ship prior to the sailing of the Mavi Marmara. Why did they do that? What I found out later on was that those soldiers who rappelled onto that ship, they had kill lists, and heaven only knows whose name was on that list, but they were looking for people. That's what I was told anyway by the organizer, one of the organizers. So you can be in international waters and your boat will be destroyed, or you physically will be seized and taken to Israel and then deported. So I think it's useful. It's extremely expensive because the boats don't get insurance, because no insurance company, after what has happened to them, no insurance company is going to insure the boats or the people on these boats. And basically what it demonstrates, though, is how out of control Israel is. And there's no such thing as international law. There's no such thing as international norms. And I think Jeff Gates has it about right. He's the author of the book, Guilt by Association. And he says that this is an international, intergenerational criminal cabal. And that's basically how I see the leadership in Israel. And ultimately, those who used, in my opinion, quite frankly, they were able to use the racism that has been honed very well in the United States. They were able to use that to burrow themselves into the U.S. deep state and eventually take it over, then bring that criminality to the U.S. in unprecedented levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. And I know Jeff Gates, and it is a criminal state. They're probably master criminals. That's why they're able to do what they do. You were held at an immigration detention center for almost a week. How did they treat you?
I was treated just like any other prisoner. I was in the women's wing at Romley Prison, and there's a friend of mine who knows my prison number. I was given a prisoner number and taken through the entire process in Hebrew. So I refused to sign the papers. Legal assistance was withheld, even though we had a local lawyer, but we were not able to see the lawyer, and the Israelis did what they did. I was held for 7 days exactly, and I was the last U.S. passport to be released and the second to the last person. The only reason I wasn't the last person who was released was because Mairead McGuire, who is a Nobel Peace Laureate, chose to remain and to fight her deportation. But of course, she eventually was deported too.
Right. I know I said Congresswoman, and I like to say that, but I'll say, Cynthia, thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this. I greatly appreciate it, and you are a great American.
Well, thank you so much for that, because that's all I've ever tried. That's all I've ever tried to be, is a full American
under
the protection of the Constitution.